Hello, welcome back to Making It Real, a podcast by TKS that follows our alumni all around the world. I'm your host, Isabella, from the 2018 Toronto cohort, and I am so excited to share these conversations, the insights, the texts, the problems that we talk about. So without further ado, let's go make it real.
Awesome, we're rolling. Welcome, Jesse. I'm so excited to have you here on the TKS Making It Real podcast. Before this interview, I was going through your LinkedIn, and you have so many things on there. I was like, damn, like so many things. Accelerator programs. You're a mechanical engineering student at Queens, which I have, like, one of my best friends is also in Mech Eng, a year younger than you at Queens. So anyway, yeah.
I'm you can take so excited.
Yeah, I totally can. Her name's Frances. I'll intro you. She's from Etobicoke like me. Yes, I'm so excited to chat. I feel like I could not properly summarize your entire history, but I'll summarize that right now we're both in East Africa. I'm in Burundi. You're in Kenya. You're there for 6 weeks, part of a Cambridge grant, if I'm understanding that correctly, and you're looking at using technology within agriculture to support local Kenyan farmers. But why don't you add one or two lines about yourself and your favorite experiences and what you're working on right now?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm super excited. And this is actually like the first time we're talking together. So like, it's awesome to get to know you a little bit as well. But yeah, I have kind of always been like super passionate about climate and tech. I think I knew I wanted to be an engineer when I was 11 years old. So kind of my whole mission in life is about how can I make the most progress towards mitigating climate change that I can. And I'm very like impact driven. So if I feel like I'm not doing something that's somehow making an impact, at least in a very small way, or like working towards my like bigger goal, I feel very like demotivated, which I think is probably both my best and worst quality. So yeah, like around 2 years ago, I got started on this project and I met my two co-founders who are both Kenyan through the YC Combinator founder matching platform. And that's a great platform, by the way. If you're not on it, I would highly urge you to make a profile. It's super, super helpful. It's like LinkedIn on crack. And so I met them through there. And then I just started talking to them. And it just started as, okay, we had the statistic. Mango farmers in Makueni County, Kenya, lose $50 million US dollars every harvesting season. That's one type of produce in just one county in one country. So it gives you an idea of the scale at which post-harvest food loss is happening. The average farmer in Kenya loses 40% of their harvest, whereas the average farm in the U.S., it's like 3%. So it's crazy. The disparity is absolutely insane. So it just started as like us talking, how can we maybe solve this problem? We entered a competition. And we were selected as one of the like 25 finalists, and we received a grant as part of that. And so how it worked is all the finalists had a year with this grant to conduct field tests in Africa. And so we spent a year doing that. Throughout that year, it became even more clear to us how much of a problem this was. So somewhere along the way, we turned into a company. And then after the competition, we kind of just decided to continue with it. So we've gotten like a little bit more grant funding here and there. We're kind of just using it right now. The year that we spent in the competition, we had a lot of like limitations, I guess, because of the guidelines of the competition. It's so annoying like when people give you funding and they're like, okay, but you can only use it this way, instead of, okay, use this to like solve the problem as effectively as possible. So there was like a lot of limitations. It helped us gain credibility and like get started, but it also limited our progress. So now we don't have those guidelines. It's like we're kind of starting from zero, but with everything that we learned, and we're just trying to find out what the best way we can solve these farmers' problem is, and like, you know, what they teach you in TKS, like understand the why, like getting down to the root cause of the problem and then figuring out how we can best support or solve it. So yeah, I've been able to come here for 6 weeks and just been going around to a lot of different places, like very rural places, like places where I'm like, oh my God, like I never thought in my entire life I would end up in this place on earth. Like it is so like middle of nowhere. And we've been talking to lots of farmers and just gathering data and figuring out what our strategy is for the next year. So it's been really, really eye-opening. Like I've learned so much, like probably more in the past 2-3 weeks than I have the previous like 3 months that I was like trying to do this virtually. So I'm realizing how important it is to be on the ground. But yeah, like I'm just getting so many ideas, learning so many things, and like trying not to get ahead of myself and just take things step by step. But I think that we found a really, really great problem space. I'm really excited about what the future holds for us.
That is so awesome. Do you see yourself relocating, spending more time in Kenya?
Yes, definitely. If I want this to work, I need to be in Kenya. Like, I need to be here. I have 2 more years left of school. I don't think I would drop out, unfortunately, unless it really, really, really made sense. Like, unless we got, like, a ton of funding or I got some sort of fellowship that required it that I thought was valuable. So I'm just going to, like, try whenever I can, whenever I have time, whenever I'm able to come back here and just, like, make the most of my time here. But then I think after I graduate, I'm probably – obviously it's very uncertain, but I think I would spend a lot more time in Kenya, at least for the first few years of my career.
And then your co-founders, they're Kenyan, but are they also based in Kenya or are they based in North America?
Yeah, they're Kenyan, based in Kenya, born and raised. They're like twice my age, so they're like...
Amazing.
Yeah, they're also like very committed. They know the space really well. They're very connected, so that helped a lot.
Super, super cool. Well, we can circle back and kind of dig into those East Africa tech opportunities, but I want to ask a question that I've been asking everyone, which is what is a mindset you've been relying on recently and why?
There's kind of two. One is like understanding the why, like I mentioned. It's so, so important when you're building a company to not just dive in, especially in a place where you're very unfamiliar. And like, I'm sure you relate to this really hard. You just come in, you have no idea how things work. So it's really like understanding the why, not being afraid to ask really stupid questions. Like you really have to put your ego aside and just understand that you're going to probably come across as really stupid, but that's how you learn. And then also like, I don't know what mindset this is, but like atomic habits, understanding that solving these problems take a lot of time and I'm probably not going to see results, like cold hard results for like at least the next 1 or 2 years, if not much longer. So that's difficult because I'm used to moving really fast and like seeing payoffs much sooner. But I think the hardest problems take the longest, and being able to be resilient and just stick it out and understand that a small step every day will get you there much faster than trying to take a big step in one day is super, super key.
And I also think you spending this time on ground, when you go back, you'll be able to be more efficient. And I know you said that you've learned more in the 2 weeks than the 3 months, but I think like the next 3 months, you'll still learn more than the first 3 months, if that makes sense.
That is so true. So true. Yeah. Because now I understand like what things actually like need to be done that lead to the most progress being done.
Yeah. I also think there's a value in having different perspectives. Like Kenyan perspective is really important. But what I've realized being, at least in Burundi, I've interfaced, there's a really cool project called Village Health Works. And it's like American and Burundian. And I had a chat with, it's actually a husband and a wife, and they're both doctors. One is the head of emergency medicine at a hospital. And it's super like high tech, because their whole thing is they want to provide free healthcare access to the poor, but not discounting. They're bringing the best machines, that kind of thing. And I realized through that conversation that even though he's not a local Burundian, his medical experience is incredibly useful in terms of the, because Burundi is a country where there's only 1 or 2 trained anesthesiologists in the entire place. Emergency medicine, there's only like so much you can do. And yeah. I think it's incredibly important to be culturally aware, like local languages, that kind of thing. But at the same time, like through interfacing with the expat community in Burundi and the NGOs that really change the stuff on ground, there's also a lot of value in having that diversity of thought. But I don't know. What do you think of that comment?
Absolutely agree. Like, I think having a mixture gives you such an advantage, because the whole point of doing this kind of work is you're advocating for change. So you need different perspectives if you want to have change, but you also can't implement change effectively if you don't understand the landscape and how things work. So I think, honestly, you would be crazy not to try and have both perspectives. You have to have both.
And a lot of these things that haven't happened, it's not like they haven't happened because they're obvious and too hard. I think there's a more we can do in this world than we have the capacity for, and there's a lot of other things that will pull your attention. For example, mm-hmm. like you could get a job graduating university at a really well-paying company in like a nice office in Toronto or Vancouver or something. You have to choose to basically forego that reality and pursue something mm-hmm. very different in a different environment, like starting up something else. And a lot of people around the world maybe don't come from a place where that's like an option. Maybe they have a huge family and them like graduating university and being the first out is an incredible milestone and they can't just take a risk like that. And then maybe there's some people who just don't find that joy in entrepreneurship, et cetera. And I think realizing that there's more opportunity in the world than anyone is attacking and understanding why that is, like why is it that no one's really approached this problem in Kenya, that's probably part of, you know, the barriers to implementation. But anyway, I think there's a lot of opportunities in the world, more than there are people solving them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and you touched on something that I've noticed as well. It's so true that a lot of these really, really hard problems that are impacting people in such a big way are actually not really hard problems necessarily to solve. We have the solutions already. It's not like you're working in a space that's like super, super technical and you have to like invent something new. It's just like understanding like exactly what the problem is and like how to implement the best solutions. That's what it is. These solutions exist. And if we wanted to, and if we had the people, we could implement them and we could solve them and help improve the lives of billions of people. But like you said, it's just doesn't always work that way. Like it is harder than it sounds to just, you have to have connections there already, which a lot of people don't have access to. You have to like spend a lot of time and sacrifice a lot of career capital if you want to do that type of work. It is risky and it's really difficult, but it's very possible. And that's what I'm realizing. So I want to long-term, I would love to figure out a way to make it easier for people like you or I to do this kind of work. And even people who maybe never would have considered it otherwise. How do we like streamline this process and like make it easier for people to like implement these solutions because they exist and it could help so many people?
Yeah, that was my whole thing that pushed me towards maternal health care, is that so many women, hundreds of thousands die each year, not because we don't know how to solve XYZ disease, but because we have a distributed and existing solution.
Yeah.
And for me, that was misoprostol for postpartum hemorrhaging. Like, you can tackle basically a third of the pie of maternal deaths for less than $1 per woman that gives birth each year. And that is a fraction of the money that we spend towards these like big SDG goals or these big institutions or like all these like activism campaigns. And in lieu of the like tuberculosis news that Johnson & Johnson is decreasing the patents in low and middle income countries, that's amazing. But we've heard this story time and time again. Here's a really cheap intervention that provably works, that can solve a disease or solve a problem, a death problem, that disproportionately affects the world's poorest people. We have that in many instances, and yet it is still not implemented. That is not an innovation problem, that is a distribution problem. Why?
Yes. Exactly. I think a lot of times it's almost like we overcomplicate things. Oftentimes I feel like the simplest solution is the most effective. And so just being able to distribute that funding in a way that actually makes sense and actually has the most impact, as opposed to sounding fancy or like high tech or whatever. Like, these countries don't need high tech. They just need like simple solutions that have existed in places like Canada and the US for decades.
Yeah. And I completely agree. And I also think, for example, in Burundi, the internet and the electricity infrastructure is not the best. In fact, like people that I was talking to, expats that had just been living in Mali, which has been in war since 2012, they said they had better internet connection in like the middle of like the northern part of Mali than in the biggest city in Burundi, which is crazy to think about. But there's a lot of reasons for that internet instability. And one of the elements of that is the actual like grid infrastructure. So that might not seem super relevant to something like, how do we integrate SMS into healthcare systems, or how can we do mobile ultrasounds, those kind of things. But you realize, and this is similar, like I was talking to some clinics locally in Bururi province in Burundi, and you realize that they might have the machines. Like, they might have like donations from Canada or the EU or whatever, and like, here's a CT scan, here's an MRI, but they do not have the capacity to power those kilowatts, basically. Like, it's not even about, like, we need the machine. It's about we need the, like, infrastructure for that. But no one who's, like, working in healthcare is like, oh, I'm really passionate about electrical rewiring and like giving Burundi great internet. Instead, like they like all cut to the chase. Like the amount of people who text me being like, can we use ChatGPT in Burundi to improve healthcare? And I'm like, no, we cannot for a lot of reasons. First of all, ChatGPT is blocked here. Second of all, I can't even like make a WhatsApp call in like an hour outside of the capital city. We are not going to be able to load ChatGPT in. Then they're like, oh, ChatGPT is going to have an SMS extension. I'm like, do you know how expensive phone credits are here? Do you know that it's only like a flip phone screen where you can see like three words at a time? Like, it's so much easier said than done when you add all these cute little solutions and you realize what we should be doing, what someone should come here and do is pave a bunch of roads, add a bunch of internet, and that will enable so much more than all these fragmented things.
Yeah, like power and like clean water, like clean running water. Yeah. I think those two things are like a given.
Sure.
When it gets more complicated than that, it's like, let's focus on what is actually affecting people right now. ChatGPT is not going to help someone who's struggling with malaria, you know,
yeah.
So that's just what I meant. But yeah, totally agree.
Totally. But in Kenya, you have the other angle of mobile phones. I don't even know if you have to carry around a wallet anymore. I mean, that's what I got from people who are living in Nairobi. They don't even carry cash anymore. So tell me a little bit about that like layer of technology and how that's influencing how you think about building your company.
Yes. So 96% of the Kenyan population actually has some type of phone, which is amazing. And what's really great about Kenya is they have M-Pesa, which is like their mobile payment method. So they can actually pay each other through their phones and it's used everywhere. So if you go and like buy something at the grocery store, for example, when you're checking out, as long as you have a Kenyan phone number, you can use M-Pesa. So they'll have like a till number. You'll go onto M-Pesa and you'll like type in the till number. And then you enter however much the grocery bill is and then like send it to them through your phone. And like that's how everyone pays for groceries and for everything else, even like Ubers. That's how you pay for Ubers. So it's really amazing. And like obviously it's not as widespread in like more rural parts of Kenya. What I've noticed is like when I go to these very rural areas and I speak to farmers, every farmer I've spoken to has a smartphone. They just don't know how to use it for things besides calling, texting, and paying. So, like, someone will have literally, like, a smartphone, like, with a screen, but they don't know what apps are. They don't know how to use apps. They don't know how to download apps. So you might think, like, oh, people have smartphones. Like, let's build some type of app or some type of website that they can access. But even if they can access it, they don't know how to. So I think it's less of an infrastructure problem in Kenya and more of, like, okay, so, like, everyone has this technology, but, like, we actually have to teach people how to use it. So I think that's, like, probably one of the biggest barriers for Vunatech is going to be, okay, we want to help people through technology, but we need to first make sure that people actually know how to do it. And so we're looking at solutions that, at least in the beginning, won't require an app. So we'll obviously have, like, our own software and, like, back-end, front-end that we use for buyers, for example, or for, like, people in the city who are trying to access farmers or, like, whatever it may be. But when it comes to the actual interface for the farmers, we have to build something that they can use, which is going to be, like, USSD or SMS. So you're going to have to, like, build both sides as the transition is actively happening. And then hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll be able to offer training and, like, people will start being more used to how to use their smartphones, and then we can implement something that's a little bit more like an app that people download. But I don't think people are there yet, at least not the people that we're working with.
Yeah. And even with building an app like that, you have to consider kind of non-sexy development things like, can this app load really quickly? And it's probably better for the app to load quicker than for it to have like a cool, hippie new animation. Or I see like these great websites, and being in Burundi, like, I'm here and I'm accessing very good internet for the standards. Like, if you stay, I mean, the thing with, like, hotels, there's no such thing as a cheap hotel here because there's not, like, not like hostels or not, like, a young, you know, hipsters that are, like, traveling in the same way that Asia has. Like, in Cambodia, I was staying for $5 a night in, like, such a good hostel, food and, like, pool, rooftop. You can go to the market and it's, like, 50 cents to go 3 kilometers, like, it was so good. But here, it's, like, minimum you're paying $100 a night. Because the market for the people who are living in hotels are, like, the people from the U.S. or the British or the Canadian government who have a project working on here, or people who are at these big NGOs. you're not really coming here for tourism in that way. I've been accessing really good internet, and I can't even load, like, the coolest, you know, YC-funded startup websites with all those, like, great animations. And it's just, like, it's given me such a layer of empathy for the accessibility of technology and how prettiness can actually come at the cost of functionality.
So true. Yeah, like, I've spent a lot of time learning about UI, UX, and just, like, none of it is applicable anymore.
Yeah.
Except for, like, yeah, like, at least not to the farmer-facing technology that we're building. So maybe we should work on some sort of, like, UI, UX course for people working in, like, different parts of the world.
You know, like, Maslow's hierarchy, like, that for UI, UX. Okay, let's do a different question, which is, I want to know what brought you to TKS, and I think I have a chance because you were saying that you wanted to be an engineer when you were 11, but what brought you to TKS, and what is one core memory you have going through the program?
So I had LinkedIn when I was really young, and I think when I was around 15, I started seeing a lot of people on LinkedIn that have TKS innovate in their bio, and I was like, what is this? And, like, after seeing it a few times, I clicked on someone's profile, and then, like, I followed to see, like, the TKS LinkedIn profile, and that's how I got to the website. And I was like, oh my God, I want to do this so badly. But at the time, I was still in Vancouver in high school, and, like, they only had it in Toronto. So I was, like, so sad. Hopefully one day I can do it. And then literally the year that I went into university, that's when they expanded to, like, virtual Vancouver, everything. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, because it's for high school students. So I was, like, entering my first year. But then I was like, wait, the virtual program, they'll take you if you're in first year university. First year only for virtual. So I was like, okay, I'm going to apply. Like, this is my one chance to do TKS. And I got it. And I was so, so happy. And, like, definitely one of the best decisions I've made in my entire life. I was, like, pining after this person that I was so in love with, and I finally, like, got in a relationship with them. That's what it felt like. So,
awesome.
But I think one of the best memories I have was from, like, I think it was, like, a year and a bit ago. Michael, my director, he hosted this TKS dinner at his place in San Francisco. And so he and his twin sister made us all this, like, really good vegan pasta, and we all just sat around a little, like, low table on the floor in a circle, and we were just talking and, like, having all these, like, interesting conversations, and it was, like, one of the first times that I ever met Michael in person. But yeah, just, like, we were just, like, bonding. We stayed until really light. The lighting was, like, dim and, like, pinkish. I think that's one of my favorite all-time memories of TKS ever.
That is amazing. I've also been to one of Michael's vegan chat cookouts. I went to one in 2021 when I was in San Francisco, and it was also amazing. It was tacos, just, like, outside. His apartment at the time was a pop-up art gallery, so he would bring in local artists and hang up their, yeah, and, like, his apartment was literally, like, an art. It was so cool. And then he would, like, every month do a community event. So I think they had just finished a chalk one. So, like, they would, like, put all these, like, ideas and basically, like, whiteboarding, but with chalk on the sidewalk in San Francisco, like, by, oh, what's that? Is it Mission Dolores Park? Like, that beautiful.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. It was, like, by there. Amazing. Michael's, like, the best community builder ever.
Oh my gosh. Totally. He's so cool, man. Like, I missed him a lot.
Totally. No, I sent him an email about a draft that I'm writing right now. Kind of like I gave you the sneak peek with what I was saying about tuberculosis, vidaculin, and misoprostol. It's just like some thoughts on global health accessibility and a framework to, like, think through that. And so I was like, Michael, please give me feedback. And of course, you gave the best feedback ever. So speaking of education, I want to know a little bit about Queen's and engineering there. What have the professors been like? And what have been, like, the most valuable skills that you've learned? What would be your take on Queen's Eng?
Sure, yeah. So one of the reasons I applied was because Queen's has the most amount of clubs out of any other undergraduate school in Canada, and they take clubs very, very seriously. And I think I've always learned the most and, like, gained the most value from, like, extracurriculars and stuff, so I care a lot about that stuff. And so, like, they have a very strong club culture. a lot of people spend more time on clubs than school. And so I joined a lot of clubs. Like I started a, helped start a club with a couple of my friends. So kind of like naturally got very plugged into like the commerce community at Queen's. So I would say most of my friends are in commerce and business as opposed to engineering. I think it's just such a good way to like have the best of both worlds. Cause I honestly, like I told you I wanted to be an engineer since I was like super young, but when I was a bit older, that's when I got introduced to entrepreneurship and started thinking, oh, this might be something I want to do. Like, I really like business, entrepreneurship. And so I was kind of conflicted and I wanted to make sure that I stayed involved in both. And so I think it's so, so valuable to be a technical person studying some like a technical subject, but also have a lot of experience in business. And that's kind of what I've gotten at Queen's, kind of like the best of both worlds, in my opinion. So that's been really, really helpful. I would say like the courses that I'm taking for mechanical engineering, like it's a lot of like theory and it doesn't feel as applicable to like what I want to do or like what I'm doing. But I think an engineering degree is really valuable regardless of what you do, because it just teaches you and trains you on how to solve difficult problems, how to approach something that seems very scary and break it down and understand, okay, like let's start here and then, okay, now we can go here. Like it's good for problem solving. So even if the subject matter isn't as applicable, I still think it's a valuable degree. And then again, like in university, I think the most value you get is from the community you surround yourself with and the actual works and projects that you do, as opposed to like the courses that you take. So I just try and optimize for like finding the best communities, becoming friends with people who I think are like-minded, and making sure that I'm like still doing projects outside of school that are helping me work towards my ultimate vision and goal in my life. So yeah, that's kind of been my experience so far. Like I've taken a lot of time off. I'm already like a year behind, so I would be going to my fourth year, but I'm going to my third year because I've taken like gap semesters here and there just so I can focus on my startups, so I can like do some traveling. And that is something I would recommend to anyone. Like you have to take a gap year or gap semester at least once in your life. You just learn so much more and it's so, so beneficial.
Yeah.
So I try not to like, Kingston is a very university town and it sometimes can feel like you're in a bubble. So it can be super fun, but it also is like, sometimes I'm like, oh my gosh, like I feel like I'm in another universe. And then when I like go back to Toronto, for example, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm back on Earth. So it definitely like feels like a bubble sometimes. So I try not to like get too enclosed in the bubble. What I've realized from traveling is that it really, really just expands your worldview. I'm sure you've experienced this too. You learn so, so much more just about you as a person, about the world, than you do by just staying in one place. So sometimes I'm like, man, I wish I could take like maybe just one semester online or like, you know, like switch back and forth. But yeah, engineering unfortunately requires you to be in person for labs and stuff. So it's not possible. But
can you do exchange or no?
Yeah, you can do exchange.
We should do an exchange. What are you waiting?
Yeah, no, I definitely want to. Yeah, I'm going to apply for it this year for sure.
Where are you going to apply?
I think I would want to do an exchange probably somewhere in Asia again.
Singapore. I loved my exchange in Singapore. It was like the best.
Oh, you did exchange in Singapore?
Yeah, I just finished it, which I think is a really good alternative to take, because I've also taken a gap year before in high school. And so I think an exchange is a really good like middle ground if you don't want to like be delayed or whatever. And then after doing an exchange, you'll be like, wait, I do want to take a gap semester. But Singapore is amazing. And I could still take good technical courses. If you can try to go to NUS rather than NTU, do that because it's in a better location. But if you do end up applying to Singapore, let me know. I'm like the dictionary of Singapore at this point. So I do Google reviews like on Google Maps, and I'm like a level 7 Google reviewer, and particularly in Singapore. Like I just became, I like memorized the streets. Like I knew all the places and like people were talking about it. I'm like, okay, I'm checking it out. Like I'm very prolific at that. But Singapore is so phenomenal. You're not allowed to do more than one semester abroad. And I am going to like do my hardest to basically get myself another semester abroad. We'll see what happens. I don't actually have that much confidence, but I'm the type of person, like, I like to, like, break stuff. break the rules, break the norms. So I'm like, okay, it wouldn't be me. Like, I wouldn't feel authentic if I didn't desperately try. So that's the plan.
I love that. I love that. Where would you go next?
Oh, I would do Singapore again. Because what? I think, yeah. So this is my thing. I love Singapore. And the reason you love Singapore is amazing is because it's in Southeast Asia. It is like hop, step, and a skip away from so many places. So I would want to stay in Singapore because that's maybe Bangkok could be like comparable. But in the region, university-wise, like it would be, it's so good, really technical courses. But next time I go, I would spend so much more time in Laos and Cambodia because I spent a little bit of time in Cambodia, but it was by far my favorite country that I went to in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm. Really?
I think it's super underrated. I mean, people will say Angkor Wat is overrated, and I would say, like, they're wrong. Angkor Wat is, like, one of the coolest things I've seen in my entire life. And I went, like, if you go online, it's like, when should I go in Cambodia? All the, like, articles will say, go to Cambodia every month except April. I went to Cambodia in April's cheapest time. And there's a reason. It's 45 degrees Celsius. The entire, like, at 6 a.m. it's 45. It was, like, really,
girl,
really, really warm. But so cheap when I went. So there's, like,
well,
there's a method to
the madness. Well, better be cheap for that.
I know, right? But it's fun. You, like, dip in the pool, whatever. Like, it was so cool. And I specifically spent a lot of time learning about the Khmer regime and, like, the history and the education. And I connected with a really cool nonprofit, a guy who runs it. He's a German guy, lives in Cambodia for over 10 years. And he runs it's either the Garden Temple Foundation or the Green Temple Foundation. Super cool dude. And he, like, took me around on his motorbike for, like, went to see so many things. So, yeah, back to my, like, point. Like, when I think about optimizing for Asia experiences, definitely I want to be in Southeast Asia. If you're in Japan or if you're in South, like, Seoul, like, those are great cities too, but the amount of damage that does on your wallet is very intense.
Yeah. Singapore is pretty expensive. Like, it's crazy
Singapore
expensive as well.
Expensive, but you have hawker centers. Like, it's so quick to, like, get on. Like, you can get on a flight to Hanoi for, like,
$80.
Like,
oh, wow.
So cheap. You get on a bus to Malaysia for $5. I did that so many times. That's why Singapore is amazing. So if I would, and I think, like, there's an argument, like, do study abroad in Australia or do it in Europe. But, like, I feel like Europe is so much more accessible. Like, I could see myself moving to London after I graduate. I could see myself moving to Geneva. Like, whatever. I can see myself moving to those places. Like, Australia maybe less so because it's so, like, far and isolated. But Australia and Canada are, like, the two most equivalent, other than the U.S., like, they're so similar, except, like, polar opposite weather. And I'm like, I will have so many opportunities to, like, live in interesting cities. I would rather be in a place where, like, you have to not just think about the city, you have to think about where you get to go. Anyway, I'm, like, such a bullish person on exchanges in Singapore.
Honestly,
so great.
You've convinced me, honestly. Yeah. I was already considering Singapore. I think that's the place I would go. So I'll definitely reach out to you again. Yeah, I will.
No, let me know when you do it, because I might want to do it not next semester, but the semester after, because you can only do semester long. I have no idea. I'm talking out of my, I don't even know, because I don't have any of this confirmed. This is, like, my little dream study in Singapore.
You'll do it. I believe in you.
Nah, I don't believe in the bureaucracy of my university at all. In fact, I've been trying to get, I'm a chemistry, but pseudo-chemical engineering, because there's no engineering school at UNC.
Oh, okay.
And I've been trying to get into a chemistry class as a third-year chemistry student, and I have not been successful. I've never been in a place where I'm like, oh my god, this is so disorganized and backwards. Like, the lack of logic in, like, I did a study abroad, I took a math class, and so I'm, like, trying to get this credit, and I'm like, that's blocking me, and there's this chain of events, and I'm like, oh my god.
So frustrating.
That's the point.
I feel like universities as an institution, as a business, they have a long way to go in terms of how organized they are and how they operate.
Yeah. So I want to go back to what you were saying about classes versus clubs. Agnostic to classes or clubs, what do you think are the most tangible and important skills you've learned from pursuing an engineering degree with entrepreneurship interests?
Definitely problem solving is one of them. Understanding, like, how to get down to the root cause of the problem and to understand the why and how to break down really scary problems into something more manageable. And I would say a big part of what I've learned is the importance of networking and being able to talk to people that are outside of your domain, but not being worried about it. I think a lot of times in university, at least what I've noticed, is people who are studying the same thing tend to like stick together a lot, which makes sense because you're kind of like going through the same thing. But I think it's so important to have friends who are doing different things and are multidisciplinary, because it gives you such a different perspective. If you hang out with people who are doing the same thing as you, you kind of like get stuck in an echo chamber.
Yeah. What do you think have been the most valuable classes?
I would say my design classes have been the most valuable. So like we have these engineering design courses that we take every year where we're put into groups and then we're given like a real project to work on, usually with a real client. And then we have to design the solution to it and do a bunch of research. And usually we deliver some sort of report to the client, sometimes a technical product. Every class that we had, we were given kind of like a lecture that was focused on one particular like aspect of the report, going through like the stages or like sections of the report. So like the first class was, how do you define a problem? And so it was just problem definition and like, how do you structure it well and like really understand? It kind of is like a little different, but it was interesting. And like, yeah, so it was like problem statement and then background research. We had one class that was focused just on like, how do you do like a cost analysis, like time analysis. And then we had to figure out what would make the most sense cost-wise. But like, what was interesting about that was like, you realize how important it is to consider the entire lifetime, not just using it throughout the project, but also like, how much does it cost to dispose of this equipment? Because that actually makes a big impact on like what one you should choose. So yeah, it was interesting.
And I think what's good about my impression of like Canada, especially in programs like engineering, is that the marks don't actually matter as long as you pass.
Yeah.
If I'm understanding correctly, unless you're on like a particular scholarship. And I think that's really great because you are not over optimizing for the details that like some professor has subjectively decided to grade. And I found that one of my least favorite parts of American universities, it's all like GPA focused and like blah, blah, blah. And like, that's like a total contributing factor. And sometimes like, that's fine. Like it's good. Like for me, I like striving towards doing well, but sometimes I'm like, why am I here? Like spending 10 hours, triple double checking this like essay that I wrote when I could spend that, you know, spend way fewer hours. And yeah, I think what's great about Canada is that unless you're doing like medicine, like you can use your university education to take risks and to try things and to not stress that much.
Definitely. And like, I find that the difference between say like an 80% and a 95% is exponential between like 60, 80. So like you have to spend hours making sure that if you want that 95 to 100 range, it's just like, I don't think it makes sense from a time view. Like I would much rather spend that time working on projects and like doing things on my own, extracurriculars.
Socializing. So. I think that's such a big element. Like when you, one of the things I'm realizing is that when you have people who kind of like get you, like get your wavelength and whatever, like what you want to do in life. And there's types of people who encourage you. They're like, oh, did you do your morning run? Like, yeah, I did. Did you? Like kind of thing where it's like positive loops where I found that if you don't have that, it's like really easy to just become like a loner, or at least like I find it really easy. Yeah.
Oh, true. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. You have to like literally like invest time to find community. Otherwise it can be so demoralizing. And like what I love about university, at least my university, is that it's like a student town. So everybody lives in like houses together. So they're so much fun. And like I find that when you're young, building community with the people that you're living with is like such a huge advantage. And like I actually had a conversation about this with a few friends who are a few years out of school, and they're like, they missed that aspect, that community feeling so much. And they called it like tribe, like it's your tribe. And so like they got together because after you leave university, it's like, bam, you're like, you have a job, you have to like, you're living completely on your own. It's so isolating. So they created their own community house again and lived with a bunch of friends who like similar mindset, similar goals. And there's so much you can do when you're living in a house with people that you align with. Like they said, it's your tribe. You can like work on goals together. You can like have community dinners and just like have interesting conversations, talk about what you learned today. I think that is such a valuable part of university. And I think That's probably one of the downsides of traveling is like you're often on your own, and like solo traveling is an experience in and of itself, and I think it's super, super important. But living with people your age who have similar mindsets to you, I feel like it can absolutely 10x your potential, and like it's so, so important. So yeah.
Agree. Solo traveling is one of the best things I've ever done. But at the same time, it's like in the last 9 months that I've mostly solo traveling, like I've just been like turning inward so much to the point where I'm like, I cannot do this for that much longer without having like a balancing force, you know? Especially like living in Burundi for the last month, basically in a rural village. I had to go to bed at like 6 p.m. every night because you can't really be out after it went dark. Yeah. It's like quarantine. It's like the quarantine of COVID kind of vibes sometimes. But in other like instances, it's also, I feel like I'm going into my like last 2 years of university with so much more perspective and like freshness and honestly like less of a caliber for like stupid things. I feel like before I was kind of like saying yes to everything, and even though I knew I actively did not like it or knew that these are not my type of people or the conversations that give me energy or that are productive, etc. Whereas now I feel like I have grown up, whereas I felt like the first 2 years of university I was kind of plateaued in growth, whereas now like I feel like an adult, whereas before I didn't.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and what you said about going inward, I relate to that so hard. When I spend even just a week pretty isolated, I just go so, like, into myself. I get into my thoughts. I feel like it's almost like a positive feedback loop for me sometimes. I need to be alone. I need to, like, introspect. And it's like, if you're constantly introspecting, there's a point where you can't make any more progress because the introspection comes from, like, your lived experience. So, like, you need to have lived experience. And, like, I don't know if you relate to this, but there's also something to be said about spending time with people your age. Because a lot of times when I'm abroad, I'm like, last year when I was in Turkey, I was living with like older people. Now I'm living with older people. And it's when I talk to someone my age, like even just this conversation, it's like, oh, I feel like I'm just getting all my energy back. It's so nice.
I agree. I think there's something about like having that level of relatability and not like being the odd one out. But I do really enjoy, like yesterday I went to pretty cool events that I was like telling you before our call, like with just like people that I was not expecting to like run into and whatever, and it was like really cool because I just heard some like crazy stories and stuff like that. But definitely I relate super hard. But also I say that now because I haven't really been in a university environment in a really long time, so I'm curious like what will actually happen, because I thought I was like disappointed in university for the first 2 years and like the community. And I think part of it is like, I mean, everyone calls Canada and like the U.S. like the most relatable, similar countries. But I actually am starting to like really disagree with that. Like, being in a small American town with people who have grown up in the United States, like it seems ridiculous for me to be like, oh, I'm an international student in the U.S., but like I'm from Canada. Like, but actually it's so different. And I did not expect for that. So I'm like curious what will actually happen like when I re-interface with that side of society.
It's hard work to find those people, but they exist everywhere is what I'm realizing.
I think you're right. So what about Turkey? Tell me about the living in Istanbul, what you learned. You worked on drones there as well. And then how does that compare to Nairobi?
Oh my gosh. So yes, I spent last summer working in Istanbul and living there. That was the first time that I'd ever left North America in my entire life. Wow. So, like, before that, I'd only ever been to Canada, U.S., and Mexico. So going there was, I think, a very pivotal moment in my life. And I was so lucky because I was living with a family, and they kind of became, like, my family. It was almost like a host family situation, but, like, they genuinely, like, felt like my family and still do. I didn't get, like, touristy experience. I got a very local experience, I would say, which I was so grateful for because I think that makes a huge difference. The tourist experience of a country versus the actual experience of a country, so different. And, like, since living in Istanbul, I've visited, I'm pretty sure, like, over 20 countries now. And to this day, like, Istanbul, Turkey, it is my favorite country in the world. I would love to live there. I want to live in Istanbul so bad. I think about it every single day. Like, I just had the most amazing time there. Like, I miss it so much. The first day that I got there, my like brother who I was living with, he was like, so what you'll notice about Turkey is that life is just colorful here. And I didn't really like understand what he meant, but by the time I left, I was like, it's so much more colorful in Turkey. Like life is just so colorful. And both in like the literal sense of like, it's so beautiful and like there's so many amazing colors and you literally feel like it's like very vivid. And, like when I go back to Canada, I'm like, whoa, it feels like the saturation has been turned down. But also in the more metaphorical sense of it's a lot less structured. I feel like when I'm in Canada, it's like I have a schedule and it's like every day is here's my schedule and I have to like put it all on my calendar and like I have meetings with people that are like only 30 minutes. After 30 minutes, we are not talking anymore.
Right.
And it's very like structured versus in Istanbul, like my life was very like day by day. I felt like I was living in the moment. I didn't feel like pressured when I was like talking to people that I was like taking up their time. Like they genuinely seemed interested in me. It was like everyone like felt like family. There's like so many cats in Istanbul, which is just, I love it. Like everyone sort of collectively takes care of all the cats. And I could rant about it for days, but it was definitely like an adjustment. There was some aspect of culture shock for sure. I went there, like both my parents are police officers and they kind of throughout my life have instilled like a healthy fear and maybe like cynicalism for certain things. I went there like thinking I'd always have to like keep covered and like, so I brought very like warm clothing and I got there and I was like, oh, everyone's so open. And so I had to like buy like new clothes that were like not so like covering conservative. Yeah, like it just like opened up my eyes to like what else is possible. And I think that's kind of when I started thinking like, oh, maybe I don't want to spend the rest of my life in Canada, because I always kind of saw myself settling in Canada. But that was when I was like, wait a second. Yeah, no. So yeah, it was amazing. Contrasting that to Kenya, I would say Kenya is honestly more of a culture shock. Africa is just so, 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 so different from even like some of the more like rural parts of Asia that I've been to. And like even when I first got here, it was like I was noticing so many things that were just very different. And like Kenya is doing really well, but there's still a lot of people who are like really struggling. And there's still like a lot of very real problems. So I think Istanbul is a very like modern city. Like you could compare it to places like New York and Paris, I think. And Kenya and Nairobi, on the other hand, is like it's still like very much a developing area. So more of a culture shock. I think like I would love to spend a lot of time in Nairobi and Kenya, and I feel like I need to in order for Vinatech to succeed. And I see so many opportunities here, and I love Nairobi, but I will always have a special place in my heart for Istanbul, and like one day I would love to settle there. So yeah,
that's really cool. What are your other, for traveling, not for living, what are like your top three places that you would recommend to people? Or if you were to tell your younger self, what would you say?
Istanbul, number one. Then I would say maybe Bruges in Belgium, because it was just like, I loved it because it was like, I felt like I was in Belle's Beauty and the Beast setting, her village. That's exactly what it felt like. It's just so, so beautiful. Like if you search it up, it's like on the water and there's like beautiful little bridges. I love that. And then maybe my third recommendation would be Bangkok. Bangkok was really, really interesting city. And like there's so much happening there. So many like expats doing really cool work. And like the thing I've noticed about these cities is particularly Istanbul and Bangkok is like I felt safer in those cities at night than I do in a lot of North American cities. I would never walk alone at 3 a.m. in New York, but I would walk home at 3 a.m. like a lot of nights in Istanbul, and I felt completely safe. So I think like there's just a lot of misconceptions about certain cities and countries that we have in the West, that when you actually go there, it's very, very different. And you realize, okay, people are like totally exaggerating about the concerns. Like you should still be like aware and careful, but like the West is not as safe as like it's made out to be, especially compared to other cities.
Although I feel like Toronto, I've never, or like Canada, I've never had personally like a problem.
That's true. There's definitely a difference between Canada and the US.
Yeah. Like especially like when we go up north and like towards Collingwood kind of thing, like people just like leave their dogs in the car unlocked, like windows open, mm-hmm. unlocked. They'll go sit for coffee. Like that's the vibe. And I was like, this is like very like nice to see. Or Taiwan. Like I felt so safe in Taiwan.
Yeah.
It was crazy. So I have some comparisons. Japan is the Italy of Asia. Taiwan is like Canada, I think, is like very democratic, very skilled, good healthcare, that kind of thing. And then I think Bangkok is the New York of Asia.
Hmm. Yes, I would agree with that. I've never been to Japan, but
me neither.
From what
Japanese
I've seen,
food is so
oh
good.
Oh my gosh, so good. Yeah.
And it's like beautiful. I also watched this YouTube. I don't know if you know Wendover Productions. You definitely do. You might not know the name. Like, if you watch any of those videos, like, why are these solar, why are there not solar panels on Africa? Like, you know, those, like, hypothetical.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
Interesting. Yeah. Or, like, how can we do nuclear fusion? This is the guy. But he made a new channel called Jetlag the Game. I love it. It's basically they turn countries or geographies into board games, real life board games. So they played Connect Four with American states. In New Zealand, they did a race, like, they turned it into a board game. They, like, race and a bunch of challenges to go from north to south. And then in Japan, they played Capture the Flag with, like, the Japanese bullet train system.
Whoa.
Or they did tag across France, Germany, and England. They would, like, do tag on the train. And, like, they'd make all these, like, crazy rules. But anyway, like, I feel like the show is just, like, so entertaining. And when I think about, like, my ideal vacation, it would totally be, like, a very intense. It's a game of strategy. But, like, in the context of, like, you get to know Japan's rail system or you get to take, like, a huge road trip down New Zealand. Like, I think that's just really, really fun. Random side tangent. So you would live in Istanbul for sure. You have enjoyed Kenya and Nairobi. I think Nairobi is a really cool spot, especially when you get to, like, know the little corners from, like, my, like, small experience there. But I really like it. What got you into agriculture specifically? Was it that stat, or were you looking for a stat? Like, what was it that led you to there?
So I, like I said, I've always been super passionate about climate change, and I wanted to, I guess, understand what were the biggest sectors or industries that were impacting climate. And I watched a documentary about, like, regenerative agriculture a few years ago, and I was like, oh my God, like, I didn't realize it had such a huge impact on climate. Like, when you think about food systems and agriculture, for me growing up, I was very, like, removed from that, I feel. And I always thought of, like, farming as, like, something, like, only rural people do. Like, I don't know, like, my food just appears in grocery stores magically and blah, blah, blah. But honestly, I think our global food system and, like, agriculture is, like, probably has the same, if not bigger, impact on climate than renewable energy and, like, the energy sector. And I just feel like it's so not talked about, especially by our generation. My hypothesis is that it's because of that typical image that we have of, like, farming and how it's, like, for more, like, rural people. Like, people don't, like, go to university. Like, no one wants to become a farmer. Like, no one goes to university in Canada and then wants to become a farmer. But, like, there's so much more to it than that, and, like, there's so many different, like, roles and things that we need within our food systems that need to be improved that involve technology, and we need those kind of innovations. It's going to be more and more difficult to grow food and produce food and distribute food because of climate change. It keeps me up at night. Like, it really, really worries me. Like, 2050, like, how are we going to feed the 10 billion people in our world? Like, how are we going to do that? I think that a lot of potential lies in Africa, because Africa has a lot of fertile land. The Green Revolution completely missed Africa. And so you have, like I said, farmers losing 40% of the potential food they could be creating. And that's not even taking into account the potential of their land. Like, it might be that they have room to double their produce.
Yeah.
So that's my spiel. That's why I think agriculture is so important and so related to climate. But it's not just related to climate, it's also a ginormous humanitarian problem. So if we're not feeding the world sustainably, not only are we harming the planet, but we're also going to have billions of deaths. that's just the reality.
And malnutrition complicates so many health diseases. There was a couple of cases of really malnourished children at the clinic that I was living near, and it's like they get malaria, and we have tools to treat malaria, but they don't have regular malaria. They have like severely complicated malaria because they are 50% of the weight they should be. And part of that is like you look at what's being grown in the region, it's like maize, potatoes, and like beans. And that's like people's diet. And they cook it on kerosene or on coal. Like this is like how people are eating. And I think it's like you cannot have health without food and wellness. Like if you think that just like distributing these like medicines is the only no, health is a complicated disease. I've even noticed working closer to public health, it's really hard to even classify why someone died. So there's a child who, like a whole host of things, malaria, he had a traditional like medicine procedure applied to him, probably not sterile, hadn't been eating for multiple months, like breast milk, he was 13 months old, and he passed away. And when you start to analyze, like, why did he pass away? Like, what was the reason? Did he have a tumor? Did he? And you realize you can't even like distill it down. Passed away from malaria, like on paper, but if he had no history of malnutrition, or if he had gone to the health center earlier, and if he had like a tumor or something, and they treated it with modern medicine, could he have survived? Probably could have. So that like cause of death becomes really complicated when you're also intercepting the lifestyle elements that so clearly have an impact on health as well.
Yes. And when we talk about the root causes of problems, the root cause of that problem was malnutrition. It was lack of food. And I think you can trace back so many root problems back to food. Food is like so tied into like who we are. And we think that we have it figured out in the West, you know, like US and Canada. We have access to food anytime, anywhere. But the thing is, we are eating so unhealthily that it's actually harming our health. So it's not enough to just have access to enough food. It's like, what is that food? What's in that food? Yeah. How is it impacting our bodies? So it's like, it's a global issue. It's not just in areas where people are struggling with malnutrition and access to food. It's like people who have access to food, what is that food? It's not even nutritious food. So it's a global problem. It impacts every single one of us.
Yeah. Well, amazing. So let's end off with some rapid fire questions.
Okay.
To them, you know. Okay, ready? First one. What's the next big thing that not a lot of people are talking about? I feel like we totally went into this, but give us the short version.
I have to say agriculture. The agriculture industry, like, there's not enough young people interested.
Yeah. Okay. Who is someone that's been inspiring you the most recently?
One person who inspires me a lot is my friend Rakan. I feel like he'd be very surprised if he heard me say this. He's one of those people that just, like, truly lives in the moment. He's, like, what I aspire to be.
Amazing. What is something you are bad at but love doing?
Anything musical. Singing, playing piano. I'm really not good at it, but I love it.
Okay. What advice would you give to your 13-year-old self?
Stop worrying about what other people think. They don't give a crap about you.
Okay. And last one, what is something that everyone should experience at least once in their life?
Falling in love. True love.
Okay. Very good. Well, thank you so much for being here, Jesse. I think that's going to be the end of this episode, and maybe we'll have you back one day.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for catching up with us. That was Making It Real by TKS, and I'm your host, Isabella. I hope you have a crazy audacious week, and I will see you next time.